Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast. I'm releasing this one a little late because typically I record the intro and the outro in my car. I just like the acoustics. However, today, thank goodness, because I do live in the high desert, it has been raining and thundering and lightning for the past few hours. And so I've been waiting for my window of opportunity to record. And so here we are. Now, for our guest this week, it's Albert Bramante. And again, another person that I just basically cold called, and he said, yes, I'll be on your podcast. And once again, his story just reminded me that the second we step out of our door every morning and go out into the world, we really have no idea what could change in our lives, what the world will bring us, what new person, what new introduction, what new experience we'll have, an experience that might change everything. And Albert's interview and his story reminded me of this. And it was a good reminder and one that I needed, that this world is still full of surprise and it's still full of hope. So now, without further ado, here's my interview with Albert Bramante.
We then meet. Now, here's the interesting thing. Even at that time, I noticed some interesting notes here. We planned to meet up, but we met up by accident the first time. We were just passing by each other in a hallway on campus. And we just greeted each other like we knew each other. It wasn't like, hi, are you, you know, it was like, and we hugged and we talked. And as we were talking, I was noticing how I was feeling internally. It wasn't, I can't say it was romantic love. I don't think there was anything romantic there. But what I was noticing was, and this may be a hard, you know, thing for audience to grasp. Every time she smiled, it was like an angelic smile. It was like, you know, like I felt euphoric. I've never experienced it ever.
Well, I start off every podcast asking my guest to introduce themselves. And I kind of, you know, this is going to be maybe a little easier for you because when I phrase the question, I say, you know, if you had to go up in front of a group of people, for example, on stage or at a conference, and you had to introduce yourself, how would you do that?
Very good question. and I think that one of the issues that I've always had growing up is like, how do I really do that? So my name is Dr. Albert Bramante. I am a hypnotist, PhD in psychology, and I also am a talent agent. So I represent actors across the board for film, TV, theater, commercial, print, and voiceover. I am a psychology professor, and I wrote a book, you know, Rise Above the Script, that was published last year. So apart from me, I think, you know, that's what I do. So a little bit of who I am, because I think those are kind of separate questions that often comes up. And I've even grappled with this too. So I'll be honest to listeners, you know, that this is a question that I've always, that's always kind of popped in my mind, like, well, who am I? I would say I'm definitely a spiritual person. I consider myself, you know, humble, a work in progress, always learning, always evolving, you know, and I would definitely say very layered. I have a lot of experiences growing up, and that kind of molded me to who I am today. So in a sense, that's who I am.
I appreciate that. And thank you. And I kind of brought up the question of being on stage because of your performance, you know, your background, the psychology aspect that you bring to it. And, you know, for me, just for example, my listeners know that I hate getting up in front of people. And the one time pre-COVID that I had to get up to give a sermon at a church, at a Unitarian church, so they were very, very kind to me.
I was having arrhythmia and I couldn't breathe the entire time. And I talked so fast that people were like, later on, there was my constructive criticism. If you could just slow down a little bit. But I thought, I just want to get off stage as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And then COVID hit in the middle of my internship with this organization, and all the other plans they had for me to speak on stage in front of people disappeared. And I was like, God loves me, or someone loves me. And, you know, I just think it is so intriguing that you've created this book, but also this kind of instructional protocol for people. One aspect is being afraid to get up in front of crowds. I mean, when you were a kid, did you think you'd be doing any of this?
No. As a matter of fact, I, you know, posted something on my Instagram a couple of weeks ago where, you know, I took a picture from my childhood where I was like 6 years old and I was sitting on my front porch. And I said, little did I know that 40, you know, plus years later, that I would be a talent agent, PhD in psychology, author, a college professor. None of that. I didn't, you know, I was nervous, but I also enjoyed speaking in front of people. But I was nervous doing that. And like you, I can identify with what you had said, because for many years, especially in my 20s and 30s, a lot of the criticism I always would get when I would even having one-to-one conversation was, slow down. You're speaking too fast. And at that time, I didn't realize it, but that might have been due to my underlying anxiety or insecurity. And that's where I think nerves come into play here. So the one thing I, you know, with me working with performers, not necessarily being a performer myself, has taught me a lot. And so the past couple of years, I've had to start practicing what I preach, because, which is definitely another element there. Because, you know, writing this book and now going on to podcasts and doing a podcast like tour and all that, I have to put myself out there. So it's the very thing I'm talking about, which, you know, adds another element to it, because I think we're very well, just all, you know, not just myself, but a lot of us are very good at giving advice to other people, but not to ourselves, you know, which is very interesting, because a lot of the things I was like struggling with, I'm like, wait, I would talk somebody through this in an heartbeat, you know, somebody else going through it. Why can't I talk myself through it? And I think there's a difference, and I think that's a normal thing. I will also say to your listeners, having nerves before a presentation or before an interview is a normal process. So it's not something that necessarily is a problem or that you're going to get rid of. I think learn to manage it and using it to work with you is more effectively than saying, how do I get rid of the nerves? But I don't know if that's entirely possible to get rid of it completely. I was even hearing, read once that even Tony Robbins himself would sometimes get a little jitters before he would do his, you know, mega events, you know, with thousands of people. It looks so easily to him, but yet there was many hours of preparation that he did before that, mentally, physically, and all of that. And that really made sense to me. I'm like, well, okay, now I know that it's a process, and that learning to use the fears and, you know, and anxieties to our advantage is the key. The reality is that most of the time, even if you say the wrong word or you trip up in the middle of your speech, no one's going to really care or remember that.
Thank because, God.
Which is true. That, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Thank goodness for that. Like last year, I went presented at a hypnosis conference. And, you know, I've presented at many conferences before, but this particular presentation, the initial presenter had contacted me an hour before the topic and said, I can't do this. Can you fill in? And I remember turning to him and I said, well, you know, yeah, sure, just give me your notes and I'll do this. And turned around and said, I have no notes. Now, it was a topic I really knew about. It was like hypnosis and anxiety. Okay. So I put together a little bit of a presentation and I went and I did it. And I was just winging it. I was just winging it. Didn't even pay any mind to it. I was just winging it. I went through it. I had a bunch of notes, but I really followed, really, you know, I didn't even look at them. I was just connecting with the audience. 21 people were in the audience and, you know, fellow coaches and hypnotists. And when I got the evaluations back, 19 of them were five out of five, like really good. One of them had a little hard time following the power, you know, the slides and my talk. And one was a bit on the scathing side, like totally disorganized. And for the first time in my life, that didn't bother me. When I was younger, if I received that, I would have been devastated, despite the fact that I had 19 glowing recommendations. I would have been focusing on that one disorganized. Because now I realize, look, I'm not going to be everyone's cup of tea. I'm not. That's the reality of it. And just like every actor, you're not going to book every room you're going to go into. Even when you give a performance, you may get subject to a harsh review from a critic or an audience member or whatever that is might not like your performance. And the important thing is looking at it as feedback.
I want to tell you that you and I are somewhat the same age, and I don't know if you watched it or if you remember this, the Brady Bunch. Okay, so do you remember the episode? And this kind of became sort of a cultural thing where one of the characters was really afraid about getting up on stage, and someone said, "Oh, just picture everyone in their underwear." I think Mr. Brady was like, and as a kid, I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. Gross.
Right. And, not, you know, I mean,
yeah. And I always thought it was so funny. And like, who came up with this in the first place? Do you know the answer to that?
No, I don't know who came up with it, but I can tell you how that works. Number one, it disarms the audience. It makes them really funny. Now, I might not say that particular metaphor, but I might say it's like a picture of everyone, like a bunch of puppies and kittens in the audience, or cartoon characters in the audience. Because this way it disarms them and you're focusing not on them being judging, you're focusing on, you know, something else completely. And it disassociates yourself from the actual, so you're you know, from the actual nerves of like, oh no. Because sometimes, you know, I've given talk on the stages and you'd see people in the audience, some people would smile and nodding, and other people would be like, you know, with a poker face on. You know, that would throw me off sometimes. And then, of course, I realized over time that that's misleading because they could still be being engaged. It's just their way of paying attention or being focused. But I think, you know, why that Brady Bunch example is so powerful is it disarms the audience. It may, you know, it takes away their power a bit. So it limits the anxiety a bit because now you're in your mind, you're looking at them as, you know, laughable in a sense. So just do go to your talk. If there's a bunch of, you know, naked people or cartoon characters or puppies or whatever that is in front of you. Puppies. So, yeah, I like puppies and kittens. I would probably say that before over people in their underwear because as much as I love the people I present to, there's some people I don't want to see, never, ever want to see.
Right. Let me ask you a question. So what came first? Was it, you know, getting your psychology degrees or was it being an agent for those in the entertainment industry?
Sure. I would say the first two psychology degrees I received, my bachelor's and master's, came first. I did that back to back, you know, 6 years right after, you know, high school, you know, 4 years, undergrad, 2 years, master's. Then I took, you know, a little bit of time off. You know, hence, I didn't get to the PhD programs I wanted to do. So I was kind of forced to take some time off. And then 9/11 happened, tragically and unfortunately. Now I started working in the social services sector and I was volunteering and working for different organizations. And so I was working a lot with like crisis intervention, you know, social services. And I started working with actors and community people. And you know, a lot of people tell me, oh, you got such a character face, you should go into movies. And I said, yeah, let me try it. I think 6 months into this, I realized I'm not an actor. What am I kidding? And it wasn't a sense of shame. It was just, look, this isn't for me. However, I love being on set. Not necessarily for the acting purpose, but for the atmosphere, the energy around the people in the room. I was like, these are my people, actors. I then pivoted. I said, you know, I can't really do this lifestyle. And, I need a job or I need some stability. And I don't really like being that much in front of a camera or bearing my soul out there. That wasn't for me. But I enjoy actors. So, and I would actually find myself looking for jobs for my the people I've met on set, my, you know, new peers or friends that I met on set. And I would start to recommend them for jobs and they started booking. And I said, you know what, maybe I should do something here. So in 2004, I started my first agency. And I've been doing it ever since. I've had a couple different companies, a couple different experiences that. While I started my company, I said, you know, I made a promise to my family, well, to myself, really, was, okay, I went this far for school for 6 years. Now, for psychology, in order to really have a decent or thriving career, it's one of those disciplines where you have to go all the way, get the PhD. So I decided to do that. Now, to add another layer to what I was doing, I was just hired to be an adjunct faculty member, part-time at a community college, right, you know, 10 minutes from where I live. So I started doing that, and I loved teaching. And, you know, I'm going to toot my own horn here. I was getting, you know, right from the get-go, really great reviews. And then I became full-time for a bit. So I was doing that, doing for a PhD, running my agency, hence running my burnout, which, you know, came around 2010, 2011, was like my massive burnout phase. And then I, you know, left the teaching job in 2013, you know, not necessarily my choice. I wasn't grad to tenure. So I took some time off. I said, now I wasn't grad to tenure. And I was working on my dissertation, which is another monstrous process, but rewarding process at the same time. I said, you know, now's the time. This is a blessing in disguise. I'm now going to go all the way. Might as well just finish the thing, receive my PhD, at least have the title before my name. So I did that 2015. And then, you know, I got back into teaching in part-time. I still do it part-time, not full-time, but part-time. And, you know, it fulfills my duty there and running my agency. So when I did my dissertation related to my book, which was Self-Defeating Behavior in Performing Artists, I wanted to look at a real world problem, because to backtrack a little bit, when I first started at my agency, I was noticing a strong disconnect from the actors I was known and was communicating with. The verbally, they were telling me their words were, I want to work. Please, I'm starving. I'm hungry, Albert. Get me out there. Get me auditions. But yet every time I would get them an audition, they were coming up with excuses as to why they couldn't do it. I have a job, I have this, I have that. Or sometimes they occasionally would blow, you know, not no show. And then when I would ask them, oh, it was caught in traffic, you know, things like that. And it really was like banging my head against the wall, like, why is this happening? And so when it came time for my dissertation, our advisor, you know, said, look to solve a real world problem. Okay, why are actors shooting themselves in the foot? At first I thought, well, my advisor's never gonna go for this. They, you know, it was a clinical psychology program. And they loved it. And I said, okay, done. So, you know, it took me a long time because while I started the dissertation, I was hired full time. And when you're hired full time at an academic, it consumes your life, which I didn't realize at the time. It was because it's more than just teaching class. Now, I was at a community college. I didn't necessarily have to do research, but I had to do committee work. I had to do advising. I had to do office hours. I had to do, you know, a whole host of things for the service of the college, which consumed most of my time. My agency, unfortunately, suffered. So did my dissertation. You know, it took me a lot longer than it should have. I mean, it worked out well at the end. But at that time, it was frustrating because it was like, this is taking a lot longer.
Right, right. Let me ask you, thank you for that. That's actually really, really interesting. And what I so appreciate about this story is that you were in the middle of this real world problem, and in the middle of this, watching these people who said they wanted jobs and said they wanted to put themselves out there, kind of self-defeat. And not only did you write a book from it, but you did your dissertation too, which is absolutely brilliant. It's like combining two things there, which is really, really, really smart. And you just have so much to say, and I'm really excited to just get to know you a little bit further. I'm going to move to our second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, how has that kind of way of worship or being in the world evolved over time to where you are today?
Well, the answer to that question is yes and no. My grandparents on my mother's side, well, my grandmother, my great-grandmother on my maternal side, were devout, Catholics, to the point where they would, rosary, go to church every Sunday, and, very big, the word of Christ in Catholicism. So I started off that way. I started off going a little bit to church here and there. I made my communion. And then, unfortunately, everyone's on my maternal side had passed away that was religious. And my mom had her own bit of a religious crisis happening, where it became disillusionment in the church. So therefore, it was never forced upon us to go to church anymore. I never did. Maybe holidays or funerals, really, that I went to church. I didn't make my confirmation. The way I look at it now is I don't necessarily consider myself a Catholic. Maybe by birth, maybe. I do consider myself extremely spiritual, though. I do believe in a higher power. I do pray. I do believe in God. And I have immense respect for anybody for every religion, that comes across. It's not for me. Organized religion is not for me. And I'm going to caveat that because I don't want anyone to think that I'm downplaying organized religion in any way. I'm not. And if, like I said, people who do, and I have friends from all faiths of life. I have friends that are born again. I have friends that are atheists. I have friends that are pagan, Wiccan. So I really embrace it all, in a sense that I respect it 100%. But I'm not, it doesn't work for me. And I'm going to caveat that for me.
That's really a thoughtful answer. And I can't even imagine being a kid and going through, getting your communion, and then your mother has this kind of spiritual crisis where she's trying to figure out or navigate what does it look like to engage with this and deal with it. And there you are witnessing it all, which is kind of a huge thing, especially through that maternal line, as you said. And there's your mother kind of reflecting or stepping back and saying, I might need to rethink some things or reconsider some things. Yeah. I wanted to just go to hypnosis. So I want to just ask you, and then we'll get to the main question, because I have a feeling you have a lot to share and I'm really excited to hear it. But you also work with hypnosis. And I have said before to other people, I cannot be hypnotized. But that being said, that was about 20 years ago. And I feel like things might have shifted and changed in that respect. When you work and you use this modality, hypnosis, and also I should tell you that when I was in college at an event, they hired a hypnotist, and it was really fascinating. It was a big group of people, and he hypnotized, quote unquote, the crowd. And some people actually became hypnotized and went on stage and clucked like a chicken or jumped up and down or did whatever, but there was no rhyme or reason for who became actually hypnotized enough to do it. So can you explain a little bit about hypnosis?
Sure. Hypnosis is really working with the subconscious mind and going into a becoming just more open to, I've said, a more open state So hypnosis is not mind control. It is not about controlling people in any way. It's, we don't change free will. There's no way that can happen. So you can never, you can't, you cannot hypnotize anyone against their will. That's the thing I will say. There's no such thing as that. What I will say is, I also think it's a misconception when people say I can't be hypnotized. Because we're hypnotized several times a day, and then we realize it. Have you ever driven, you know, a long distance and then didn't realize, you know, you just pulled up at your destination, like, where did the time go?
Yes.
That's a trance. That's a hypnotic trance. If you watched a movie for, a 2-hour movie, got so caught up into it, got emotional from it. Even though you know consciously this is fake, you still got emotionally caught up into it. That's a hypnotic trance. Have you ever been engrossed in a music or a book and somebody next to you is talking to you and you can't even hear them?
Yes.
That's a hypnotic trance. We're in the process of hypnosis. We're giving you to that state by design. You know, you're going to those states, you know, just by, you know, randomness. Here, we're just doing it by design, getting in that same state. So it's called, another way I look at this is a concept of flow. If you ever heard the word flow, that's what I want everyone to kind of know. That's exactly what hypnosis is. Getting into that state of flow. So it is not, you know, I mean, I know people see, you know, someone swinging a watch and then boom, you're going to be a chicken. I don't necessarily do that. And, you know, I mean, it's fun to watch, but that's not going to happen. You know, I mean, you know, again, the most people that I would say were more successful in these shows have an open mind. They're already going in there being receptive and they're having fun while doing it. Even though it might seem like they're out of being automatically, they're having fun doing it. So it is not, you're not, they're not being, doing anything against their will. They're having a good time. All what you've done is just lowered your inhibitions a bit. It's almost like the same thing alcohol has, but without the alcohol. So you're just more receptive now. You know, I also kind of work with hypnosis and therapy. So the reason why I got interested in hypnosis was I was becoming a little disillusioned with clinical psychology. When I was going to grad school and, you know, both for my master's and PhD, I had a lot of questions, which I don't think was really appreciated. One of the questions I've always had was when someone would say, like, tell a case story. I've been working with this woman for 8 or 9 years, and we're still working together. I'm like, if they're still in pathology in 8 or 9 years, something isn't right here. Now something's not adding up. Of course, that would make me consider a maverick in my field, you know, because it wasn't adding up. So what hypnosis can do in hypnotherapy, if it's really, you know, where both parties are really participating, it can really shorten the time of therapy, traditional therapy. It's not a miracle thing. Like, it's not going to be one session. Okay, you know, now I'm going to heal 20 years of trauma in one session. But at the same time, it may get a lot shorter than, you know, several years, maybe 3 or 4 months of consistent work can do a lot of significant healing.
I'd love to move to the main question of the podcast, which you and I discussed a little bit before starting our conversation. I ask every guest that comes on, I would love for you to share either one story or multiple stories where you feel like you either witnessed or experienced something that was magical, mysterious, or miraculous.
Well, I can kind of, you know, I want to talk about the main experience, which, you know, kind of know about a bit. Because I feel like that kind of falls under two, you know, at least two of the three, you know, categories. So the first thing I would just say, you know, even like just sometimes for me, subconsciously knowing things. So when I would go to a lot of these hypnosis conferences, I would encounter people that are mystics, you know, or even have psychic abilities. And they would always come up to me and say, you know, Albert, you're really psychic. You're really spiritual. And I didn't necessarily believe that. I don't have visions. I don't have premonitions. But I have had a lot of people tell me that sometimes I would make statements that I wouldn't even realize I'm saying that spoke directly to their soul. Like the last conference that I had presented at, I don't even remember what I said, but I was talking about like the concept of soul families and soulmates. And I turned and I made a remark and she said, I looked right at her. And what the statement I made was exactly what she was going through. And I felt, I don't know what happened. I don't even remember what I said. Because she said, oh, I'll tell you later, because we were a bunch of people. I said, so what did I say? You know, does that, and she's like, I'll tell you later. We never reconnected. And maybe I don't even need to know that, you know, exactly what I said. But it was just that, statements like that, that I think are like everyday miracles. I'll tell you two stories. The first, the main one, another one I had when my grandmother passed, my paternal grandmother passed away when I was 14. And it was a very hard passing for me. So we were going through her things, like right before her funeral. And I remember I don't even remember doing this, but somehow I walked out of the house with her ring in my pocket, her wedding, like a wedding ring. And I remember coming home and like confessing it to my parents. I was crying, you know, like, I'm so sorry. I you know, I didn't mean to do this. I'll have to return it. And it so happened that that was the one thing that they wanted, my parents wanted. So I have to think, and again, I don't, you know, if people believe in this, was my grandmother directing me from beyond to do this? So that was a miracle. Now, the second one, miracle, is a story that rocked my world when I was, you know, 30 years old. So I was in the middle of my PhD program and it was an online, it's an online school. So, but in order to maintain accreditation standards, we had to do multiple residencies throughout the time. And I've like, it was like 500 hours of face-to-face time. So the first one was a 2-week stint in Minneapolis and it was at the University of Minneapolis, where we had to, you know, attend classes. You know, it was like classes all day long, seminars all day, workshops all day long. So at that time, and this is going to date me, this is when MySpace was available. And we all remember MySpace. Some of us may. But anyway, my school had set up a MySpace group for Walden. You know, it was like, what's going on with school, Walden University? So it was for this particular residency. Because it was all different disciplines. It was not just psychology. It was education, business, nursing, and all that. And it was just kind of a way to connect, roommate share, all of that kind of thing. So I started talking to this lady from California who was going for her PhD in education and leadership. She was a teacher for many years and wanted to become school sort of supervisor. So we started chatting, and it was not anything romantic. It was pretty much a nerdy chat. I mean, we were talking about educational theories. We were talking like really, you know, literacy programs. It was nothing like anybody would find. It was not in our field exciting. But we were different fields in different parts of the country, different ages. He was considerably older than me and than I was. So we then, you know, she was going to come the second week of the residency because that was in her program. So I went down there and I started giving her some tips. I said, you know, when you get here, do this, this, and this. We then meet. Now, here's the interesting thing. Even at that time, I noticed some interesting notes here. We planned to meet up, but we met up by accident the first time. We were just passing by each other in a hallway on campus. And we just greeted each other like we knew each other. It wasn't like, hi, are you, you know, it was like, and we hugged and we talked. And as we were talking, I was noticing how I was feeling internally. It wasn't, I can't say it was romantic love. I don't think there was anything romantic there. But what I was noticing was, and this may be a hard, you know, thing for audience to grasp, every time she smiled, it was like an angelic smile. It was like, you know, like I felt euphoric, like she were crushed with her smile. I've never experienced that ever. So I remember walking, even going back when the conversation was over, saying, what was that? Because I was like, she had the smile of an angel. So the next day we were chatting again, and we were going to get together because a group of people put together, like, let's go out to dinner at this pub. You know, there were like 10 to 12 of us that were all different programs. We're just going to get together, and she was going to go. And at first she wasn't going to go because she said she had a headache, which is going to be a precursor to what I think happened a few weeks later. But she was saying she had a bad, really bad headache. But she wound up going, and we sat next to her. We were all chatting in a group. And again, this isn't going to date me, but we had cameras, but it was those cameras at that time, you know, for a long distance ago, we actually had to get them developed, you know, wait a week. So, and I was never much of a picture taker. I really didn't like my picture taken. But I said to myself, I said to her, I said, I want to take a picture with you, which was really out of character for me. And we did, we took a picture. And I remember walking back, again, walking back to my room saying, what the hell is up with me? And we take a picture. It was like kind of like mocking myself. What's gotten into me? Anyway, we didn't get to see each other the rest of the time. It was like a really intense few days. So we started texting each other on the airport. This is on a Saturday. I'm going to start mentioning the days because this is kind of giving in context of what happened. So we started texting each other Saturday in the airport, going back and forth about, like, yeah, we're sorry we didn't get to see each other more. Let's reconnect, you know, because I was at that time I was going to go to the American Psychological Association convention in San Francisco, California, which was 45 minutes from her. So we had agreed that, you know, for maybe an entire day, we would just get together. She would introduce, you know, show me around. We'd have dinner and reconnect. So we were talking all about that, getting excited about that. Sunday night rolls around. She's going. She had a hard time at the convention. Something went through. She went through her, you know. Had kind of a and I don't want to discuss her business, but I hadn't had a momentary lapse in judgment. So I was kind of talking her through that. And we spoke for like 3 hours on the phone, almost 3 hours. And at the end of the conversation, so it was Sunday night, she said, I love you, Albert. And I turned around without even thinking, saying, I love you too. Hung up the phone. I didn't even think anything strange about that. So the next, yeah, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we have lengthy text conversations that even on MySpace Messenger, talking back and forth. And we and starting every conversation was, hey, I love you. And it wasn't just love you. It was like, I love you. And I love you too. And I started looking forward to these messages. The last conversation that I had with her, we had another deep conversation. And she said to you, question to me was, do you think I'm a, like, in her perspective, do you think I'm a bad person? And I responded back, absolutely not. I think you're incredible. And so this is Friday. Now, I had to go to New York because I was presenting at another conference, psychology conference in New York. So I was very nervous, and she was giving me a pep talk Thursday night. You got this. Let me know how it goes out. Friday rolls on the conference. I don't hear from her. Now, she was going to go to the family, so I assumed she was very busy with family. Saturday rolls around. I still don't hear from her. It was my second day of conference. It's Saturday night in July. I log into MySpace and I see a message from somebody I don't recognize with, please call me, in all caps. Okay, so I call her and she's like, you know, when was the last time you spoke to Mary? I said, 2 days ago. And she said, how did she sound? And I'm thinking, like, this is odd. Okay, sounded great. Mm-hmm. Well, she's like, I'm sorry to say, but Mary passed away. And I think, you know, that feeling of sleep paralysis sometimes when your mouth can't move, when you just wake up, that's how I felt. I was locked. I think I was able to mutter out what happened because all I heard the next was she was with her family. You know, she was in the mid of conversation. She was, you know, started to laugh and just passed out and never came to and died. And I was frozen. And I remember hanging up the phone saying, you know, to my family, you know, my friend at Walton just passed away. And everyone was like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I went to bed. I was just numb. I woke up and I was crying in a fetal position, wailing. Now, for months, I couldn't have a conversation or even look at a picture without crying. So I was having an immense grief reaction. And I think intellectually, the pragmatic side of me was like, what the hell is going on here? This is a woman who I don't even know. Less than a month. If you talk about the month of that's the time we started talking, and the moment she passed, it was not even a month. Why am I reacting this way? So a few weeks after her passing, her friend, you know, reached out to again, say, how are you doing? I said, I'm having a hard time. She's like, well, I want to let you know a few things. She's like, you know, she's like, I don't mean to upset you, but you were number one on her contact list. Her name, you know, like on her list. She couldn't stop raving about you, you know, her friend Albert. And that really got to me, it affected me too. I was like, oh no. Her kids reached out to me saying, you know, her teenage children at the time reached out to me and said, you know, my mom couldn't stop talking about you. I thought I would introduce myself to you. It doesn't end there. So I posted a tribute, like an online message board about her with her picture and saying, you know, thank you. You know, I'm really distraught. And I wrote a poem about how she really helped me and how much I thought she was a good person. A few months later, I get an email with the subject line, thank you. And it read, by the way, I'm Mary's half sister. We were estranged, but after reading her post, I reconnected with her family. And I'm now in, you know, my niece and nephew's life. That changed things. So now I started thinking like, maybe he has no, because I was angry for a long time. Why would you, you know, give me this connection, universe, and take it away from me? And what I started to realize the lesson was, well, maybe it's not entirely about you. Maybe I was also there helping her out on her way out. And now I'm thinking that maybe that angelic smile was because she was, transitioning or about to transition. So that changed my view about things, you know, tremendously. Again, you know, some people may listen to this and may think, okay, this may not be, but for me, that's what I felt like. So it changed my perspective on the entire thing. But out of all the deaths I think that rocked my world, that was probably number two besides my paternal grandmother. And yet what was mysterious about it was it wasn't a person I really knew. And then I realized, you know, because some people brought out, I was talking to somebody else who's really into spirituality and said that, well, maybe you didn't know this person in this lifetime. Maybe it was somebody in your soul family or someone who had previous life connections with. And maybe this was just a wake-up call to change your direction. Pow. I mean, that was like a huge thing. So. Yeah, I will say that that's probably the most number one thing, aside from my grandmother, that really brought me the concept of miracles.
Yeah, I have to say that you don't expect to just meet someone who might change your life in a MySpace.
No.
Message board. And I'm sure it would maybe was the last thing on your mind, at least finding someone that you can forge a deep friendship with and respect and have such great conversation and who has an angelic smile. And I love the idea that you both are in this residency and then you bump into each other in the hallway as well. There's something really for the first time when you meet in person for the first time, you kind of encounter each other in this hallway and it's almost like a movie. It's so beautiful, but then, you know, she also, it sounds like, was in this place in her life where she was struggling or had some questions about who she was and how she moved in the world. And you were there for her to help her maybe understand herself or give herself a break, at least. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
I would think so, yeah. I mean, you know, and that's where I think that that's where it kind of took, helped me take the perspective, like, well, maybe this is not always about me. Because again, I was wondering, like, for a while, why did this happen to me? You know, why would I be given such a strong connection and then have it ripped from me like that? But it wasn't ripped, really, if you think about it, you know, in that perspective. That's where I came to realize, no, this wasn't really ripped for me.
Yeah.
I was in another form, in another form.
Yeah. And you also, it's so interesting to me, you provided a service for her, for Mary. Not only being present to her and listening to her and helping her to understand herself, but even after she passed away, you provided a service for her in bringing her estranged half-sister, you know, back into the family. And it's like you both had this deep friendship, deep relationship, deep understanding of each other, and you showed up when she needed you most in her life, at this crux of her life where she was really struggling. And then suddenly, shockingly, she passes away. And even after that, you're able to bring gifts to her family.
Yeah. And that's where the purpose of this interaction came into, you know, like it was a deeper thing. And it woke me up because really wasn't that, I mean, I've always considered myself spiritual, but I was so grounded in like science and research and all that. And I think it just was a wake up call of like, okay, there's another side here of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, I can't even imagine. It was probably a whirlwind for you. And when you're in the middle of it. Yeah, I mean, a whirlwind can be great and it can also be really destructive. But this sounds like a whirlwind of friendship and comradeship and conviviality. And I just want to just say how sorry I am again at the loss of Mary, because she sounds like she was a really big light.
She was. And I even said that to her. I was like, you know, when I told her about the angel, I did tell her that. I was like, you know, you did kind of an angelic smile. And she's like, oh, I never heard that before. I was like, okay, interesting. So I'm kind of, you know, again, maybe I'm the only one that saw that. I don't know.
But you're still here to testify and let everyone know. And I think that's part of the gift as well, like the continuing service you're providing for Mary and her family. So. Mm-hmm. Letting everybody know. You know, it's very, I don't know how you've experienced this, but meeting people like that in our life, it's so rare and so uncommon and so special. Sometimes we don't even understand how special it is when we're in the middle of creating those relationships.
Yeah.
But they're very few and far between.
Yeah. I never had any idea, even going through the middle of this before I got that faithful call, that I would have known that this was going to be that intense. You know, and even afterwards, and I probably think, I don't know if I'll, I mean, I'm grateful if I never have an experience like that again, I'm still going to be grateful. But I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't looking for it, you know, the dawn, and it just happened, you know, to me. So, you know, I don't necessarily know what, you know, if that'll happen again. And I'm not, you know, and I don't think those things are going to happen by looking for them. I think they're just going to happen if they're going to happen.
And I also think it goes to show that, you know, you wake up every day and that might be the day that your life changes on a dime and something so beautiful is brought into your life. It should give everyone hope, or maybe looking forward to crawling out of bed every day, because you never know what kind of, you know, human being or animal or puppy, as we were talking about earlier, that, you know, is going to come into your life and just change it forever.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. You know, and that's part of like why I think it's important to be open, you know, I'm open-minded and everything, because you never know what can happen and meet people, you know, and that's one of the biggest, you know, even in my book where I'm like, put yourself out there because you never know what will happen. And even if nothing happened initially in the beginning, you never know.
All right, everyone. I hope you loved the interview, and I hope you really appreciated Albert opening his heart up and telling this really powerful, but also very devastating story of meeting someone that he didn't even know and wasn't expecting, but who changed his entire life. And what I thought was especially powerful was that even after her passing, their relationship was still changing other people's lives. And I guess that just goes to show that we never really have any idea of the ripple effects we're going to have in this life, even after we're no longer here. And that's kind of beautiful. And it gives me a lot of hope that all of the small contributions I make, all of the conversations I have, the gifts I might give my friends, that someday someone will think back on me and it might make them maybe think about the world in a different way or consider something else a little bit differently. So yeah, I love that part about Albert's story. A really powerful reminder that we can affect worlds even after we're no longer here. To read up on Albert and the work he's doing in this world, do click on the link in the episode show notes. And you know what? This week, I think I'll put a little link in there to my website. I'm launching a new podcast, hopefully within the next month. We'll see. Crossing fingers and toes that that does happen. If not within the next month, then within the next 6 weeks. But that's all still a bit of a surprise. But there's a little hint on the website if you want to check it out. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Albert. Yes, time has passed. Yes, Albert has had a moment to reflect on his relationship, a moment to consider the ramifications, the meaning of his friendship, a friendship that was totally, by the way, unexpected, and one that took him completely unawares. And, you know, instead of becoming embittered and becoming sad and becoming angry at the world, Albert is facing outward with hope and faith and joy that the world still has beautiful things in store for him, while also holding this unexpected friendship that he developed in his heart. So be like Albert and greet every day with the hope and possibility that when you step out of your front door, something utterly magical, utterly miraculous, and astoundingly amazing is waiting for you out there. But you gotta leave your house, okay? That's the deal.